Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
When it comes down to it, what are we at our core? We are North American waterfowl. Hello and welcome to the North American Waterfowler Podcast. My name is Elliot, your host here. I appreciate you guys tuning in for another one. And I've got an announcement here. I am going to take a little bit of a break. I've decided to take a few weeks off. I don't know how long the break's going to be. I'll know when I'm ready to come back. It'll be anywhere between 3 weeks to 8 weeks. I don't know. But I have been grinding out at this. I did 103 episodes since January 1 of 2024. And so I'm still enjoying it. I'm still loving it. I promise you, I'm going to still crank out a ton more episodes. It's just slowing down, and I find myself just kind of wanting a little bit of a break. So in the meantime, I've got all those episodes for you to go and catch up on. And don't forget my YouTube channel, Freelance Duck Hunting, over there on YouTube. And like I said, I am committed to continue to bringing you guys content on a regular basis. I would just like a few weeks where I just didn't have to worry about it, just to kind of recharge, reset. I've got some turkey hunting plans coming up, so I'm sure I'll do some podcasts on that. And then when I get it going again, we're going to be going full steam. I'll be in the meantime, I'm trying to come up with more lists of guests and topics and things of that nature. And don't hesitate to contact me on Instagram or email me on what you would like to hear. Your thoughts and your feelings, podcast ideas, because I will be getting it ready and we will be rolling. So I appreciate that. Today's guest is PJ. Can't remember how to say his last name, but I interviewed PJ last week, I believe last Monday. And so I'm doing the intro for this. And I can tell you that this discussion I had with PJ was one of the more entertaining interviews I've ever done for myself personally. It's just so much fun to just sit and get to know someone and talk about their hunting, talk about their life. Especially I'm fascinated in a way with the East Coast. Now, not so much duck hunting on the East Coast. Of course, I am interested about that. We're going to talk with PJ in depth about his hunting on the East Coast, but the lifestyle over there. I was born and raised in the heart of Kansas, on the plains of Kansas. Now I live more on the eastern side, more in the forest area. It's the very beginning of the eastern deciduous forest. But our population density here compared to the East Coast is so much less, as you know. And so when I think about myself personally, when I think about living in, like PJ said, he lives 30 minutes away, 45 minutes away from Boston, that's just mind-blowing to me to think of living around that many people. Same thing with my friend Matt Vachi. I find it fascinating. So I always have lots of questions for those people about where they live, what it's like. And so PJ and I go in depth about his business, which it turns out that he owns a brewery. And I find that very, very interesting. And so we talk quite a bit about that. We talk about Boston in general and all his hunting life. And, you know, I was pretty impressed with the rich hunting life that he has out there. I would have kind of thought the way that he makes it sound in the scene, well, I'll just let you hear it, but the way he makes it sound is better than kind of what I would have thought with that many people around. So I am excited to bring that to you guys today. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into this. And like I said, this will be the last podcast for a few weeks. But you can always come over and meet me on Patreon, patreon.com/freelanceduckhunting, over there for more content. And don't forget the partners. Final Approach, fabrand.com, code is FDH10, Onyx Hunt, for all of your satellite imagery, and it just helps you scout. And then also Motion Ducks Decoy Spreader, which the FDH10 is the code over there as well. So thank you guys so much. Let's go ahead and get into this interview with PJ. I think you're really going to like it. So I just noticed you're in a very interesting location. This is PJ Mercier, by the way. Thank you for joining us tonight, PJ.
Thank you for having me.
As we jumped on, I noticed that PJ's in a very, very interesting location. I asked him where it was, and he says it's – what do you call it? You said business. You call it your own brewery. What do you call it?
Yeah, it's a brewery. It's called Navigation Brewing Company.
And there's tall vaulted wood ceilings in the background. Looks like an absolutely amazing place. And before we hit record, he's like, let me go grab a beer. And how many taps do you have back there?
We have 16 at this location.
Oh man. How many locations do you have?
Two.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. So when I married my current wife, I'm not a huge drinker. I sit down, I have two or three beers. I don't like overdo it or anything, but, I was on a fixed income when we got married, and she's not a drinker at all. And I had been drinking Natural Light pretty much my whole life. And she said to me, she's like, no. She's like, I don't drink, but if you're going to drink in here, you're not going to drink trash. So you better get some stuff that isn't going to make us look bad. So that started me on like actually liking good beer.
Yeah, and that's so cool.
Yeah, I got into because beer is such an acquired taste. Like with only within the last 2 years have I started liking IPAs. They've always tasted just like trash to me. And then one day it's like you sip one and then one day all of a sudden. Like it just flips and it actually tastes good. It's a weird phenomenon. So tell us a little bit about what you got going on there. Some of those beers you have on tap, your business. I'm personally curious about it.
So we brew over like 200 different beers. So we're constantly rotating everything. So if you come in week to week, the 16 beers on tap here. But week to week, you'll have, we'll kick probably 4 to 5 of those beers, and then we bring new ones on tap. So that's what we do during the week is brew the beer. And then at night, Wednesday through Sundays, the tap room is open for people to come down and enjoy themselves and have a few pints. And that's about it. It's really just it's a community gathering place, really.
Right. Which is so cool. I'm guessing you're somewhere in your 40s, late 40s?
Wow, good guess. 40, what year is it? 47.
47. So how did you get started with this whole?
My father-in-law was not, he was a, not your average home brewer, probably like how we think of duck hunting. That's how he brewed his home brewed. When he was retiring, he had asked me, we used to always tease, joke about opening up a brewery. Cause he was always brewing really great beer. So, when he decided to retire, he said, "Hey, what do you think about opening up a brewery?" And I was like, sure, let's try it. Let's see what happens." Really started as a joke and then it took off. We're been in business, 10 years actually today. Mm-hmm. It's been a fun ride. It's allowed me to be able to get out and go duck hunting a lot. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's fantastic. What were you doing before this?
I was a land surveyor. So I was a land surveyor for like 22 years. So I did a lot of development sites. I did a lot of wetlands delineations, a lot of like deed research. So, you know, just the, and then everything from being the guy on the road, side of the road, you know, looking through the transit, to the guy in the office putting all the stuff together, to the guy going to, you know, city meetings or town meetings to debate with the town on why we should build homes or why we shouldn't build a, you know, whatever they wanted to build.
And then you started the brewery, and then how long did it take for this to become full time?
It was about 3 years, I'd say, before it was a full time gig. Yeah. So a lot of hours worked.
That's fast. That's fast.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really good. So
how many beers were there when, was it the full lineup of beers? Like how many did your stepfather have and how did you progress in your number?
Oh, he had like 30 years of brewing experience. So he would, I always tell people when we give the tours, I go to church every Sunday, he would go brewing every Sunday. And he would do that all year long. So he's got, like I said, we've brewed over 200 beers to the point, and I don't even think we've scratched the surface of his recipes.
Wow. Go through, I'm a total ignorant when it comes to actually the process of making beer. So go through that with me. What does your room look like, first of all? I'm assuming if you have that many beers, you've got a massive room or warehouse somewhere that you're brewing all these different beers. And how many do you have going at a time? What's the process?
Yeah, so we have 5 8-barrel tanks in our other location. And so we're brewing 2 to 3 times a week. So you're constantly rotating things. So when, you know, you brew something, it typically takes anywhere from 10 to 14 days from the day you brew it to the day it's ready. So, you know, twice a week, 3 times a week, we're emptying tanks and then we're filling them up. So if I empty a tank today, I'm going to brew tomorrow and fill that up with another beer. So it's just a constant rotation thing. So we're always, you know, there's always something to do at a brewery. Most of the time it's cleaning. But it's not.
What are those made out of? Are those wooden or metal or?
No, those are stainless steel.
So, stainless steel. Okay.
Yeah, double walled stainless steel fermenting tanks. The brew kettle is essentially a stainless steel big boil kettle. So what you do is you take grain and then you mill the grain down, and then you make like almost what like it looks like almost like an oatmeal. And you let it steep in the in hot water for a long time. Depending on what types of beer you're doing, you're looking for that what they, we call it's a mash. We call mash. You're looking for that to sit between about 145 and 155 degrees for about an hour, and then you run that off. And what comes off of that is called wort. And what that does is you're then transferring that over to the brew kettle. And then you're brewing that wort for anywhere, usually from most of the time, it's about 60 to 90 minutes, depending on the style, depending on what kind of beer you're brewing. And you're adding hops, or if you're adding adjuncts, if you want to do like a chocolate stout, you'd add some chocolate at that point. We just brewed one recently where it was a soured cherry stout. So if you like cherries, it would be your thing. And then from there, you cool down. After you're done boiling, you what they call is knockout. So you create a whirlpool just like you would in like a swimming pool in the backyard, and you're getting all that sediment to the middle, and that allows you to draw all the liquid off, and you're transferring that liquid over to the fermentation tanks. So you're dropping the temperature from a little under boil to like 68 degrees is usually your average temperature. Through heat exchangers, adding that into the fermentation tanks. And then from there, you add yeast and you let the yeast do the thing and make the alcohol out of that wort. It's like a sugary tea almost.
How do you control the alcohol content percentage levels of it?
The sugars. So the more grain you're going to add to something, the more sugar you're going to get out of it, and that's going to increase the alcohol.
As far as you personally, what is your sweet spot for alcohol content to where the taste, Like for me, if you get above five at all, I don't like it because the taste is just too alcohol-y. What is that for you?
I'm probably between like I my cutoff is like 6.5 personally. We brew beers that are like 10-12%. But we do most of our beers are probably between the 4.5 and 7 range, depending on what it is. I like to, you know, me myself, even though I own a brewery, I'm not actually a big drinker. I probably have a couple drinks a week, if that. Can't get high on your own supply, I guess. But you know, I like to have a couple beers on a Saturday afternoon or something like that when I'm sitting out by the fire pit. And, so I'd like to have a couple. So I don't want to, again, I don't like that feeling of getting drunk myself. So, I just shut myself off on them. So, but that's my sweet spot. So 5% is a good, that's a good beer. Yeah. You can have a couple, maybe 2 or 3 of those and you're feeling, you know, you're feeling all right.
Yeah.
We brew some beers that are like 9-10% that, you can, they drink like 5% beers. So you got to really like, you know, when we, you know, legally here where we are in Massachusetts, we can only serve anything over 9%. We have to serve it in a glass 10 ounces or less. So it's regardless, you're not getting a 16 ounces or something like that. And then we're also, you know, you have to limit people to how many they can have as well. Right. So, you know, you just don't, because again, that's just liability and it's just not, you don't want people stumbling around. So
they must have hidden it really get that well. So last question, unless there's some other things you think you'd find interesting. I guess I have 2 more questions. What is the difference between a stout and a porter and a black?
So a black is just typically, it's usually just a coloring thing. So you're going to use some malts that are going to have, they're going to give it like a black coloring. Your porters and your stouts, the difference is the roasted barley. So you're going to have roasted barley in your roasted oats and roasted barley more so in your porters, and your stouts are going to be more of like a chocolate malt or, trying to think with some of the other ones, you're going to have a lot of like carrot malts in them and stuff like that.
Okay.
Just a little bit different.
I had a black one time in Scotland that it may have just have been the right place and the right time, which like anything you eat food or whatever, it's like, if you're in the right place, the right time, it just tastes better. But I had this black in Scotland that I profess to be the best beer I've ever had in my life. And ever since then, I just don't hardly ever see any blacks. When you go in, I see porters, I see stouts, but it's like that black, I just don't hardly ever see. And I'm always on the search for that style of
beer. So you're going to want to look for what they call those as Cascade Ales.
Okay.
So those are typically what you're going to look for. That's going to be that darker black ale.
Right.
Yeah, if you can find something that's the style, Cascade.
Cascade, that's good to know. So last question, what is your favorite couple of beers? And what is the name of your place in case anyone's out in your area? And I guess, where are you located? What's the name of your place and 2 or 3 of your personal favorites that you guys make?
So again, it's Navigation Brewing Company. We have a location in Lowell, Massachusetts. And we have another one in a neighboring town, Chelmsford, Massachusetts. We just opened that up probably, 3 weeks ago now. So that's where I am today. So that's the new home, the new location. So, but my personal favorites, it's tough to tell. You know, we brew so many. I'm more of a style person, so I like a nice dry Irish stout. I like saisons and a lot of the Belgian styles as well. But I'm always down for an IPA or a pale ale, providing that they're, you know, they're brewed well. And they got to be, those beers really have to be fresh too.
Yeah. Nice. And for those of you listening, I had no idea of his business until we just hopped on. I just personally find it interesting. So this is not a paid promotion in any way at all. It's just, I just find it interesting. And so I'm asking questions, but, and I don't know if I was daydreaming. Did you tell exactly where you guys are located?
Yeah. Lowell, Massachusetts and Chelmsford, Massachusetts.
Okay.
So that's about 35, 40 minutes outside of Boston, west of Boston.
Great. So do you guys sell in stores, local stores, or do they have people have to come to you?
No, they have to come to us. We only sell it in the tap room. So we'll sell you know, we'll serve it in the tap room, and occasionally we'll can the beer too. So we'll have cans to go. What we do is we fill jugs they call growlers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We'll fill those too from time to time.
Nice.
It all depends on the supply.
Well, thank you for sharing that information. I found that extremely interesting. Let's go on to the duck hunting now. So,
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
As yes. I mentioned in the intro, PJ does a lot of duck hunting in the northern side of the Atlantic Flyway. We had on Captain Perez, and he was more of sea duck, exclusively sea duck hunter. So I wanted to get someone from the Atlantic Flyway that was more of a puddle duck hunter. And actually, PJ reached out to me and said, hey, I know that you're looking for people from, you know, bouncing around North America, and I might be able to give you a perspective of kind of the upper Atlantic Flyway. So I'm really curious to hear kind of what your duck hunting is like. Let's start off just with like a typical year for you. Just describe it to me. Where are you hunting? How much are you hunting? What is it like? What are you shooting? Just give me kind of an overview of your waterfowl hunting. Just 30 minutes outside of Boston is where you're located, you said.
Yeah. So, the business is I'm probably 45 minutes outside of Boston, but even that, I mean, they're sea duck hunting right in Boston. I typically, my season starts, we get early goose season in September. But it's usually still pretty hot out here. So that's kind of hit or miss. There's something about being 80 degrees laying out in a layout blind that I'm not really fun. I don't find that fun. Occasionally the weather will drop and we'll pick up some. So we have an early Canada goose season where we can get like 15 a day. We'll go out a couple times during that season, but the season mostly starts, cause I hunt northern Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire, a little bit of Maine sometimes. When I say southern New Hampshire, I'll go all the way up as far as like Concord, which is almost about an hour away from where from where I live. Mostly puddle ducks. We're hunting a lot of swamps, a lot of rivers, a lot of like oxbows off the river. Pretty much anything from kayaks to a duck boat, or even walking in as well. Going after mallards mostly. Typically like to shoot the mallards myself. You know, we have a lot of wood ducks, a ton of green wing teal. We'll get an occasional blue wing in the area. That's usually like, there's not many, but we'll usually get a couple each year. A lot of black ducks, and I said wood ducks, black ducks. It really depends what you're going after. I mean, I can go in like 45 minutes to the, about a half an hour closer to Boston, and you can start getting more like ringnecks, gadwall, still getting the mallards, more black ducks. But that's pretty much the species here.
What is the countryside? I imagine it to be quite a few trees and kind of rolling hills in that area. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I'd say rolling hills. A lot of trees. There's a ton of trees out here. It's not like out west where you can see forever. You can't even see your neighbors half the time. So it's a typical New England town. you know, you've seen them on TV and movies and everything else. So yeah, you get everything from rolling hills to some small mountains around, some little valleys, you know, where the river, where the brooks and the rivers are. But yeah, just a typical New England town.
Now, are these, so mostly a lot of it is creeks and little rivers and swamps, you said. And how often are you hunting in proximity where you can see houses?
I typically try to find places where I'm as far away I can possibly be. Just because I just like to, you know, feel as though I'm not encroaching in people's backyards. But there are some spots like in New Hampshire, the law in New Hampshire is you can't fire within 300 feet of a house. So there are some spots where we're like 500, 400 feet from houses. Mm-hmm. You know, those are again, little swamps. And then you get other areas where, you know, you don't have any houses around at all. You know, it might be a half a mile before the next house. It all depends where it is. And the properties out here too, a lot of the spots I have, the properties are big. So you have a lot of, you know, 5-6 acres. So a lot of the times they're, the houses are closer to the street, obviously, and you're hunting like, you know, maybe between some yards out back on a conservation area or, you know, state land or even sometimes private land. So
most of what you're hunting is public though, but some private, is that accurate?
Yeah, I consider myself a public hunter. There's probably, I probably have like 2 or 3 spots that are private. It's more so, access to get to public, just a quicker way to get out there, get off the beaten path from everybody else, get away from the boat launch, and then try to sneak in the back door.
What's the pressure like out there, the competition?
There will be guys out here that will tell you the pressure's super tight, but you know, I would have to say those guys, they're the ones hunting, you know, they're hunting at the local, you know, the conservation area or the public spot, and they're not hunting far from the boat ramps. But I don't find where I hunt, there's not much pressure. I try to find those spots that nobody else is going to go to. You know, if I have to hike in 2 miles, I'll hike in 2 miles. I have no problem with that.
Now my perception of that area would be that there would be a huge number of anti-hunters on the East Coast, and maybe you have to be careful with who you even tell that you engage in this activity, or how do you navigate that, and what is that like?
No, I'm pretty open about it. You know, I do a lot of, when I talk to people about it, it's more so giving them an introduction to it, letting them know that it's not all, you know, the stuff they see on TV, like this goofy, you know, hunter in the woods shooting at everything. Right. It's mostly educating people on it. And nowadays too, I'm finding it even easier because you're finding people who, you know, want to eat all organic and they want to, you know, they want free range everything. And I try to explain to them that, you know, what I'm eating is probably the most organic thing you're going to get.
Yeah. It's way more free range than those free range chickens that are in just a little slightly bigger cage.
Yeah, exactly. I always tell people it's you should read the FDA regulations on cage, the difference of a cage and cage free. It's only an inch.
Yeah, right. It's not what people think of it as, these happy little chickens roaming the hillside, free and content in their life.
Yeah, nothing like that. The cage is just a little bigger.
Right. So, well, I know they restricted your limits out there several years ago. It was still only 2 mallard drakes and 1 hen last year, right?
No, this past year they actually bumped it back up. Yeah, it was 4. I want to say it was 2 years straight, I think they did it. It might have been 3 years. No, it was 2 years. We lost a lot of hunters because of it. Facebook Marketplace that year when they dropped that limit, guys would go out the first year, the second year going into it, you could find everything you want on Facebook Marketplace. Guys were selling their whole setups. And I bought up a bunch of them. So
I can't imagine just like, I'm done. I mean, I guess there's just casual, there's a lot of casual hunters, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just can't imagine. You just got to weather the storm on something like that. I mean, our limit was two mallards in the, I think, 91, 92 here in Kansas. We had a two mallard limit.
Oh, all right. I did not know that you guys had limit restrictions out there. The funny thing was, is I actually shot the year that they dropped it. I actually shot the most mallards I'd ever shot in all the years I've been hunting. And then I was looking around going, I don't know why they're restricting these numbers because the numbers are up there. So they did bring them back. We're up to four. So you can take either four drakes or you can take, we can only take two hens at the most, mm-hmm. but we're pretty much targeting the drakes when we mm-hmm. go out. But you know, the hens eat well too. So,
right. And what is the limit on black ducks?
Two. They bumped that up. I want to say like 3 years ago, I think they bumped up the black duck limit. We get quite a few of those.
How much of your bag over a season does the black duck make up? I don't know if you keep your numbers.
I'm not the greatest at keeping my numbers. I try to keep everything in my head. I'm just, mm-hmm. it's just one of those things. I used to, when I was a big deer hunter, a long time ago, and I would write down everything then. But when I started duck hunting, it was more so just based off of memory. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to write everything down. But I probably, like this past year, I got at least a dozen black duck. The black ducks really came into play those 2 years where the mallard limit went down. So you would try to target the black ducks first. Mm-hmm. Right. And then go after your mallards afterwards. That way you know, it was a bonus really. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, better to shoot those than it was to, you know, it stunk shooting two mallards. It was bad. You changed your hunting style a lot over those couple of years where we would have passed up some woodies early on before, we were taking those guys out early on. You know, they come in that first light. We would kind of let them play around in the decoys, not taking shots at them, and then hoping that the mallards coming in, you know, you'd shoot them. But then we figured, hey, when we can't, you know, when they drop your limit like that, you gotta do something. So right. We shot a lot of teal and a lot of wood ducks those 2 years.
What is your total limit? Is it five, six?
Six.
Six, okay.
So we can get six, yeah. We can get the four mallards, we can get three woodies. We can get a bat. We can get, you know, when I say teal, we have it's green wing mostly mm-hmm. out here. So mm-hmm. you can get your six, you know, your six green wing if you want.
So would your ideal limit then be four drakes and two black duck drakes? Would that be?
Yeah, that's a good day.
Yeah. How much success do you have? Is it difficult? Is it challenging, or are they abundant?
It's challenging. This past year I got 78 ducks. And that's hunting Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. Right. How many hunts was that?
I think it was 39 hunts I did this year. Okay. My last day of hunt was actually on my birthday, the 29th. Of December.
So you're right around the two ducks.
About two ducks. That's about the average, about two ducks. Mm-hmm. It was about a dozen. It was a dozen, dozen black duck. Got a bunch of woodies this year and a bunch of teal. But the rest of them mostly mallards.
Did you probably didn't because it just came out today, but you didn't happen to listen to today's podcast release, did you?
I did listen to it today.
Can you imagine?
No,
I can't imagine. Five and a half mallard drakes a hunt.
I was one of those guys that would I was reaching through. I wanted to reach through the radio and just feel like, what is wrong? I'm going to tell you right now. I'm going to go visit this. Never had a reason to go visit up there, but I do now.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I live in a great state, and the idea of averaging five mallard drakes over the course of a season, to me, if someone said they did that in Kansas on like 40 hunts, I would say, I need to find out what you're doing. I don't know, because I've never heard of anything like that. And this is a great state. And I've never dream of someone. Now, they can shoot seven. So even if it was here, like, you know, if, let's say they said they averaged 4.5 mallard drakes a hunt over 40 hunts, I would, unless I knew them personally, I'd be calling BS probably.
So. Yeah. I mean, I would have been the same. I would have said the same thing, you know, and they talk about the migration and everything shifting. And if that's the case, that we all know where they're shifting to.
Yeah. Right. Right. Actually, that area has been about number one on my bucket list to go to before I even realized that type of success was coming out of there. And I'm sure that he is the upper end of the guys that hunt out there. There's no way your average guy does that.
He's able to scout
all the time and has free time and knows what he's doing. But just
he gets laid off.
Possible.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Yeah. Hey, it's good to be young, I guess. That's for sure.
Yeah, no the time. Kidding.
I mean, after the, you know, at 38 times this year, I was dragging my feet towards the end of the season. So,
yeah,
but I'm typically around that 40 mark. It depends on the year. This year I was trying to open up a second location, so I couldn't get out as much as I really wanted to, but yeah. I typically go out, you know, 3 to 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. I try to avoid the weekends. When I do go out on the weekends, I'm usually taking the kids out. Or taking a buddies out, or, you know, hunting with somebody else. But during the week, it's on my time. So, mm-hmm.
That's a good number, 38. I'm yet to know how many times I would hunt if I could hunt whenever I wanted. I think it's probably would be about 50, but I don't know. I don't have a desire like some of these guys in the South. I'm going to hunt 60 days straight. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. That sounds exhausting. No days off? Really? I love the couch. I really do love my couch.
Oh yeah, the couch is a wonderful thing. And you know, not for nothing, but I, you know, when you can also pick your days too. Like there's some days I just do not want to be out there. You know, yeah, I guess if you're with a bunch of buddies, it could be some fun, but I do a lot of hunting by myself, and if I do go out, it's usually with one or two guys tops. But you know, other than if we're bringing kids out, we bring out kids, we'll bring out a whole bunch of them so that they can have some fun too. But
right.
But yeah,
that's great.
That's a lot. I think it's going to be on my bucket list now.
Yeah.
I know Kansas is there. I know Arkansas someday, who knows, but.
They're tightening down the restrictions out here. That's for sure. They're tightening. Starting next year, it's going to be Sunday, Monday, Tuesday is all anyone coming in gets starting next year. They haven't passed it, but it's going to happen. They're going to.
Yeah. You're almost better off, you know, at that point, if you're going to be spending that money, you almost, you know, going to a guided hunt almost, you know, getting somebody to go out there with you or leasing, not leasing, but, you know, finding some private property if you can find it.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, the sport's on the decline. And public opinion is on the decline of hunters, and these government agencies just want to shut people out. And I mean, honestly, they act as though an out-of-state residents are like, or non-resident hunters are the evil enemy. And I just don't get it. I mean, this sport is declining. We know it's declining. Why in the world would we want to just continue to tighten the noose around people's availability to hunt? It's just mind-boggling to me. It's really short-sighted. In my opinion.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes if they're, you know, stacking the deck inside some of these departments and these agencies with anti-hunters to slowly just, you know, squeeze our necks. But, you know, the thing that shocks me with the out-of-state thing is, like, especially up here in New England, there used to be a big economy for hunting, you know, guys that were going, you know, moose hunting or deer hunting in New Hampshire or Maine. You know, you'd drive into these towns and there'd be a big sign on the hotel saying, welcome hunters. And you would, you know, these guys would go and the woods are big up there. And you would have guys go up for a week and go hunting, you know, not necessarily ducks, but they were hunting deer, moose, bear. There's still a big market up here for it, but it'll cost you. That's for sure. Right. It's really tough.
So when I think of the East Coast, I've never been to the East Coast. I've been into South Carolina a couple times in my life, 25 years ago. But when I think of the East Coast, I think of nothing but big cities and then suburban sprawl. And where you're located, how much wilderness is there Like how, if you're in the heart of Boston, how far do you have to travel to get into what you'd consider true countryside wilderness?
Well, true countryside, you're going to have to go, you know, again, it's more like farmland, you know, like mm-hmm. your small 40-acre, 100-acre dairy farm type mm-hmm. style, farms. You know, now mostly like hay fields or corn fields. A lot of the dairy's gone away. But you know, I'm 45 minutes outside of Boston. I have 4 acres. My neighbor, we have a shared driveway, goes off the end of a cul-de-sac. My neighbor has 6 acres. So we got like a 10-acre compound. Mm-hmm. I have bear, coyote,
wow,
bobcat strolling right through my yard all the time.
Mm-hmm. That's good to
I shot a monster buck last year. Not 2022. I shot a monster buck. You know, he dressed out at 210 right at my front yard, sitting fantastic. In a tree stand. Yeah, I mean, so we have them out here. Massachusetts, especially where we are in Massachusetts, if you're a deer hunter, I mean, it's unbelievable. You're going to be probably in somebody's backyard and probably see their house or hear their dog barking or something, but you're going to shoot a deer that's over 200 pounds
wow.
all day long. And they've got some racks on them too.
That's good to hear that it's maybe not quite as tight in as what my perception is of it. I think living in those areas and I start like getting short of breath of like claustrophobia. I can't that many people. That's just too many people to be impacted in. I grew up on the plains of Kansas to where they're almost, I mean, there's trees along the creeks where I grew up. But the hills, you look across the hills and it's mostly just grassland hills. So, and that was from like age 3 to 18. So when I moved to the Kansas, Missouri border where the eastern deciduous forest starts. And when I got into like the Ozark areas and I couldn't see anything, I didn't freak out or anything, but I had a feeling of, claustrophobia is not really the right word because I wasn't panicking or anything, but I didn't like it. I was out of my comfort zone not to be able to see for long distances.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, we're used to that. When I travel, anytime we travel outside of the state, you know, and you can see more than, you know, a mile down the road, you're like, wow, everything's so open. So right. But we can't, you know, we don't really have that here where we are. But it is, you know, whereabouts in, you said to Carolina, whereabouts in Carolina did you go? I mean, 25 years.
One time I went to Myrtle Beach one time on a college trip. And then the other time, I don't remember. I think it was a near kind of South Carolina University or South Carolina State. I mean, because I was there visiting a friend when I was 17. So I don't know. My geography, I didn't care. I was just there.
Well, if you were out in the, I was going to say like the Appalachian Mountain area, that's very similar to the White Mountains and the Green Mountains in Vermont and New Hampshire. So you're going to get, you know, you can see the mountains up there. But that's tough hunting. We don't, I for ducks especially, I don't even bother going up that far for ducks. But we pretty much, we're down in the low valleys. You know, trying to pick them all off.
So talk to me about the migration. I know that area, you guys get significant snowstorms, on a yearly basis that's my perception anyway, from watching the weather, kind of the jet stream kind of comes right up through there with a lot of moisture. What was the weather and migration like this year compared to your normal year?
So the last 2 years have actually been, very little snow. So we didn't get snow in 2022 into 2023, we got very little snow. It was a late season. So early 23, towards the end of the winter, we actually got, you know, probably, I don't know the numbers, but we didn't get much snow the last 2 years. This past year, we barely got any. We've gotten a lot of water. The last 2 years have been, you know, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. I mean, we have, you're hunting a lot of flooded areas, especially off the big rivers. So little oxbows that typically would dry up, they were wide open and nice. Full with, you know, ankle to knee deep water all season, which was really awesome. And then, you know, it's flooding cornfields, which is, you know, we don't get to hunt those types of things out here. So, you know, when you get an opportunity to go hunt a flooded cornfield, I feel like I'm probably out where you are.
Right.
We don't get that. So the past 2 years, it's been really good. I mean, we've gotten a lot of rain the last 2 years. I mean, it was coming over the riverbanks. There was one spot that I had gone to, and I only go there when after it rains because it floods up the cornfields. But this year, instead of ankle deep water, the knee deep water, it was waist deep to chest deep, which is just, I mean, that, to me, again, flooded corn. I just got to find where to move to where I can get that year long, because that to me is, it was like going on vacation, you know. Yeah. And then a lot of guys won't even bother attempting to go out to it because they don't know how to hunt it, or they're just not prepared for it. Mm-hmm. It's more, they don't know the property. Mm-hmm. But when you get an opportunity to do something like that, man, that's the best. And we had a lot of opportunities this year, but the downside to that is that the ducks have a lot more places to go. Mm-hmm. So you really have to rely on a lot of motion and some good calling in order to get those ducks to peel off and go to you rather than go see their buddies down the way a little bit.
So it was warmer. That's why you were having the rain instead of the snow.
Yeah, it was significantly warmer, which is, again, it's been like, hey, if this is global warming, I'm bringing on, man, because the duck hunting's been awesome. I'm pro warming if that's the case. Yeah.
So it didn't keep them up north of you at all then?
We get a lot. We do have a lot of ducks that, that breed in the area, especially your mallards and wood ducks. Mm-hmm. So they stick around. I mean, the wood ducks here won't take off until it's, things start icing up. Those really cold ones. Green winged teal will hang around even after some ice. Those are hardy little birds up in this area. I don't know how they are up in yours, but
yeah, shoot them clear into January. They're tough.
Yeah, same in Piesto. We can, when we go all the way to January, they're definitely hanging around. I'm trying to think. Mostly the mallards. So again, we had a lot of ducks that are born in the area, so that they kind of stick around, and they're not really coming that far either. I mean, we if you get tags, if you get a banded bird, like the furthest banded bird I ever got was from like Nova Scotia, mm-hmm. which, as the bird flies, is really not that far from us. It's a direct route. We get a lot of birds coming off the ocean. They're in the salt marshes. So we'll get a lot of those birds, especially the black ducks will come out from up there. So out here, you guys don't have seagulls, right? I'm assuming you don't
have seagulls. We have gulls.
Gulls. All right. So in the wintertime, the gulls, they don't go south. They move inward, right? So they're going to go, they go hang out on the lakes and everything else. And it's almost as though the ducks actually, they don't necessarily go north to south more, but they go east to west.
Hmm.
The oceans don't freeze, so they'll take off. In those southwest wind days, though, I mean, when you get a warm up and the ice is melting, you do have a bunch of birds coming back. They don't tend to go too far because they can go from where we are. They can go down to as far as like Connecticut, southern Connecticut, and they're in, and there's no ice, so it's a state like Kansas is probably the size of New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts combined.
Mm-hmm.
It's really small up here. I mean, I think New England itself is probably smaller than some states, but we get,
where do your birds end up south? They go clear down.
I think the Carolinas probably, most of them go to Carolinas probably, honestly, a lot of them probably stop in the Chesapeake.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to go straight down, they're going to go down the Chesapeake. But I know a lot of guys that in Massachusetts, you have where I'm considered like north, like central and then North Shore. If you go down to the South Shore, which is like Cape Cod, those guys down there, I mean, they get less snow than we do. They get less, it seems to be a little bit warmer and it's only an hour away. But those guys, they kill it down there. I just don't like to go travel. There's a lot more pressure down there. I would think. Again, you're closer to the ocean. You get a lot of guys that hunt the coastal marshes, mm-hmm. and then the sea ducks as well. So they don't have to go far. I mean, if I go an hour north, I can go an hour north, and from where I am, and you could be ice fishing, and you know, and it's the water and it's still flowing, and no ice where I am. So you don't have to go very far to get that.
Have you lived in that area your whole life?
Yeah, I grew up in this area. So I grew up, like two towns over from where I live now, two towns over from where I grew up.
So I don't know the geography that well. So help me out. Like, how far are you guys from New York City?
I could be in New York City in 2 hours.
Oh, it's that close. Crazy. Well, how about Philadelphia?
Philadelphia, I think, is a 6-hour drive, if I'm not mistaken. It might be a little bit, maybe 4 hours, maybe 4 hours.
Baltimore?
You know what? I want to say that's probably like New Jersey. I can get to New Jersey in 6 hours. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Baltimore is probably 8 to 10 hour drive.
So
I might be off an hour or two on that one, but
yeah. So I assume you're a Patriot, Celtic fan, Red Sox fan?
My kids are. I grew up like in baseball. As I got older, I'm not really big into the whole sports thing. The only thing I really like about the sports is it's good for the economy when they're winning. That's
right.
It.
Right. So you weren't a huge Patriot fan through all that dynasty or anything?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to be a fan. But I grew up when the Patriots stunk. So
right.
So
yeah.
I remember when they went to the Super Bowl in 1986 against the Bears, uh-huh. and they got humbled. Yeah. And as a 10-year-old kid, you know, that you think that these guys are the greatest guys on the earth. They're going to win the Super Bowl. It's going to be the greatest thing ever. And then you wake up the next morning and you're like, they lost. I can't believe it. I hate these guys. Yeah. You know, we had the Red Sox. I mean, for the longest time, the Red Sox, the same thing with the Red Sox. You know, I grew up in an era where they were never good. So you were fans, but then when they got good, you're like, heck with it. You know, because you're more upset that everybody likes them now. Now that they're winning.
Right. So were you old enough to be a Larry Bird fan then?
Oh, yeah. Heck yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. 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 I had a Larry Bird poster in my room when I was a kid.
Yep. Yeah.
Larry Bird's the man.
It's funny because, I mean, Boston will never experience the kind of success through that whole run of the Patriots because the Red Sox were really good during that time too. I think the Celtics with Paul Pierce had a couple of great years. I mean, it was unbelievable. Yep. And now it's kind of flipped to Kansas City a little bit because the Chiefs are on this run. The Royals have been to the World Series twice since 2015, which for us, we count Kansas Jayhawks, at least we're right on the line. So most of us do in that. The Jayhawks have won a couple titles during that time frame. So it's kind of shifted from Boston to the Kansas City because we're only like it's about 45 minutes to an hour from Kansas City to Kansas University on one. So it's kind of all lumped together. So you guys kind of handed it off to us.
You can take it for a little while.
Cause just like you were saying, when you were a kid, when I was a kid, we had the Royals were really good in the late 70s through like the mid 80s. They won the World Series in 85 with like George Brett. But after that, we went through a futility with the Chiefs and the Royals were just either trash or heartbreaking. They'd break your heart. And finally now it's like, okay, we go from that to what we're experiencing now, which possibly could be considered the best quarterback of all time or second best or whatever. It's just unbelievable. It's like, these are the best sports moments of my life. And I prefer it the way I've experienced with like so much heartbreak. And then you experience this versus these kids that are growing up on it and don't realize.
Yeah, they grow up on it.
You haven't had any heartache to really appreciate it. And it's going to be over and where you're never going to experience again. You're just going to be chasing. You're not going to know how to deal with the failure.
Yeah. I grew up. It was Dallas Cowboys and San Fran was awesome. Actually, the first baseball game I ever went to was it was an opening day at Fenway Park against the Kansas City Royals.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And we whipped you guys butts.
Oh, I'm sure. So what do Boston people think of people from New York? Is there a lot of rivalry? Like they can't stand each other or mutual respect for each other?
I think it's fun banter, I think is what it is. I mean, some people will get, you know, they'll have like the Yankee stink shirts or, you know, all that stuff. And I think when it comes down to it, I don't know, they're rivalries, but nowadays I don't think it matters, especially if your team's no good. Nobody really cares when you have two good teams. I mean, it was, in 2004 when we went up against the Yankees, I mean, that was awesome. I mean, if there was anybody we had to beat, it was those guys. And I mean, they were up what, 6 games. I mean, it was crazy. I just remember my oldest was born that year, 2004. And I was like, this is so unbelievable. And my wife was a big baseball fan too. And I'm like, this is so unbelievable. And then they have these runs for years. And then everybody, like I say, everybody starts, all of a sudden, everybody's a fan because they're winning.
Of course.
And I'm like, yeah. And then I grew, you know, you kind of grow out of it too. I couldn't even tell you a single baseball player on the Red Sox right now.
Yeah.
I just don't pay attention. I stick to my work and duck hunting, and that's about it, really. So.
I've fallen off with sports tremendously. Actually, it's a shame because with the Royals, I was an avid fan my whole life. Like, because they were not on TV when I was growing up. It was radio. It was a radio sport.
Yeah,
it was playoffs, maybe game of the week or something on a Saturday, but it was a radio sport. And baseball is a fantastic radio sport. I think it's probably better radio sport than it is TV because you can just go about your day with a little earbud in. And all of a sudden something happens. And I followed them all through the 2000s and I dropped off. Like I would listen to about every game until they were so out of it and so bad, I couldn't take it anymore. And I'm like, I can't, I'm done.
Yeah.
It would normally happen at about the 40 game mark. I mean, we had put up multiple 100 loss season over and over again. And I kind of dropped off right around 2014. To that, like everyday listening, right when they got good, and I was into it, but I had just not like I had been when they were bad, unfortunately, but now it's like you only have so much space in your life, like I can't just duck on as much as I do, and then watch all the games every second. It's like I've got a family, and I a wife, and it's like you can only have your way so much of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I'll watch a Celtics game from time to time. One of my sons is a big basketball fan, so he loves the Celtics. So, you know, I'll watch a game when he's watching it. Football in the house is really not, I mean, we don't really watch much of it. It's on Sundays, you know, most of the time on Sundays, but you know, by the time we get out of church, we get home, you know, usually go to the in-laws, you know, it's usually during, I'll usually put the game on and end up falling asleep. That right. 1 o'clock game to that 4 o'clock game. And then, you know, wake up from a nap and be like, all right, what happened?
Napping while sports on is a great nap. It really is.
Absolutely. The best is NASCAR. Oh, it's zoom, zoom, or golf. Just put that on, insomnia cured, open night. Period.
I've never understood NASCAR.
I got an uncle that listens to it on the radio.
You go to that event, you can't even tell who's winning. I mean, it's like you got to watch the board. I'm like, I have no idea who's even in first place at this point.
Yeah, I have no clue.
Oh, the first place guy's passing a bunch of guys. It's like, oh, he's lapping him. And then you're just cheering for a wreck, and that's not good.
Yeah.
You don't want to be sitting there cheering for a wreck.
I don't want to see that.
I do not get NASCAR.
I don't understand it. I don't understand it at all. But again, it's not very big up in the Northeast anyway. I mean, we got one speedway up in New Hampshire, but again, it's not like down south. I remember I was traveling down south to go visit family in Tennessee, and I pulled over in Bristol. I want to say that's North Carolina or South Carolina. And again, no clue. I pull in to a hotel to stay overnight, and the lady behind the counter starts laughing at me. She's like, it's NASCAR season. I was like, yeah, so yeah. I just need a room. And she's like, you're not going to find a room for another 200 miles. And I'm like, you kidding me? And she's like, nope. And she wasn't wrong. I drove another 200 miles before I found a room. And I still paid double the money because it was NASCAR season.
Oh, that's crazy.
It was crazy. I said, well, I'll never do that during NASCAR. I have to follow NASCAR to find out when I can go down south. But it is
not fanatics. Fanatics.
Now, you guys out there, were you guys, you said there was some restrictions going on in Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are those restrictions happening? I'm kind of curious because I want to see what's happening, if this stuff is going to start happening up here in New England.
Well, non-residents will only be able to hunt Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday of every single week. So they can hunt. You can hunt as much as you want, but it's only on Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays.
Oh wow, that's and is that for public land only, or what if you were yes. what if you were to get so if you were to go on private land, you can be a non-resident.
Yeah, it's public land, and you could hunt the navigable rivers, which there's a couple of them. But any public land of any kind that's going to cover. So, pretty much, I mean, people aren't going to make trips here. I mean, selfishly, there'll be times where I'm like, this is great. Because there are way more out of state hunters than the last since COVID really is when it started. Kind of started peaking, started about 2015 on. So there are a ton of them, but if you work hard, I don't experience a lot of pressure. If you know where to go and work hard, it's really not that big of a deal. There are times in which there's so many plates in the parking lot which is really strange to me, and I haven't quite figured it out. It's like if I go into a parking lot and there's 15 cars there and 10 of them are out of state, it does make me feel pissed off. And I'm like, why? I don't know that guy. Or if it's someone from my state, I don't know him either. Why does one make me so upset and the other when I don't know either people? I guess it just comes to like, this is our state, our place,
yeah,
you know, type of thing. But you do feel that way. But when it actually getting in the way of my hunts, it just doesn't happen very often.
We don't see much. Like, we'll see a lot of guys from New Hampshire come down to Massachusetts because of the splits.
Mm-hmm.
The splits in New Hampshire usually fall right around Thanksgiving, like right before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And then our split in Massachusetts is usually right after Thanksgiving. Ours coincides with the deer shotgun season. So it's only 10 days, although you can't hunt on Sundays in Massachusetts. So it ends up being, you know, like 12 days or 14 days if it falls on a holiday or something like that. But that's why I hunt both, because New Hampshire starts a little earlier, but it also ends like December 15th, season's over. But I'll use that split a lot of times, or those Sundays, to be able to go out, you know, if it's a good weather day, or if I can sneak up to another spot that's, you know, just bounce back and forth, because I'm literally, I can drive 10 minutes and I'm in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So.
Well, right now there's probably they're probably going to start restricting the season with these droughts that continue to go on. But as of right now, and for ever since I can remember, you can essentially start teal hunting the second week of September, and then go, if you're going to snow goose hunt, go into the second week of March, and not hardly have any days off in the state, because we're cut up into four zones, and it's not that big of a state. So if you're willing to drive a couple hours, there's sometimes a 5-day period in there where you can't hunt from like January 1st to 6th. But other than that, if you're willing to drive a couple hours, you can hunt nonstop from that teal clear to the end of snow goose season. I mean, that's like half a year. That's 6 months.
We have a late Canada goose season as well. That's usually from mid-January until like mid-February.
Ours is mid-February too. It opens somewhere in November, our goose season, dark goose, and then goes. So duck season closes, then you've got dark goose still open till mid-February, and then you can slide right into snow goose right from there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we can get snow goose out in New Hampshire, out in New York, up in the Albany area if you wanted to go get them up there. But yeah, we don't really have many in Massachusetts. They probably get some on the western side, right on the New York border. Connecticut River runs through there, so they might, you know, they probably get some through there, but nothing where you're going to be setting up those huge spreads. That's for sure.
Yeah, fun. I like to chase them a little bit, but it's more headache than it's worth and more work than it's worth. I'll go out a couple times. I've got a video coming out here in about a week or so of the snow goose I went on this year. If I go out and shoot 6 or 7, I don't want to get in one of those things like, we shot 365 snow geese. Yeah. It's like, no. I didn't. I may have shot
six of them.
I'm not eating those, and I'm not ditching them.
Yeah, you can't ditch them. Yeah, that's. I've weeded out a few guys over the years. I've taken out some guys, and they were, you know, we'd go out, we'd have a banger day, and then they'd be like, at the end of the day, the guys would be like, "Oh, do you want these ducks or do you want these geese?" And I'm like, "Why? You don't want them? No, I don't eat them. Like, what the heck are you doing out here?"
Right.
Like, yeah, what are you doing out here? Like, you mean you don't eat them? Yeah. You're missing out, man. These things are great.
They are. And they're delicious.
I don't know what the can of the goose like tastes like where you guys are, but they're delicious over here.
They're a little tendony. They're not as good as duck. They're a little tendony. Where by that I mean you'll take a bite and have to, like, you know, every now and then. But they're fine. I have no problem eating them. I prefer duck for sure.
I personally prefer a duck, but the goose is the Canada goose. Is, they taste good. Yeah, they're good. We can cut them up. They make great jerky.
I think way too much is made of, like, this duck is the best duck. To me, I know there's differences because I've done taste tests between, like, a gadwall and a mallard and whatnot. But ultimately, if you know how to cook any duck, it's going to taste good.
And there's
not that much. It's a scale that is a very small sliding scale to me to which one's better. Their duck is duck, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would. You have mallard, you have black duck, right? Those mm-hmm. are the bigger ducks. Mm-hmm. And then it's like the difference between that, you have then wood duck and teal, which are mm-hmm. just super small and tender. So there's a difference in that. Taste wise, I don't think there's much. It's just the tenderness of the meat,
right?
I think. But I 100% agree. You know, if you cook it right, you can make anything taste good, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I enjoy eating them. My kids enjoy. That's what we do. So when I go duck hunting in the morning, I drop the ducks off at the house. I have a special son with special needs. He's a nonverbal autistic, okay. And he loves to pluck ducks.
Oh,
so
wow.
he'll pluck the ducks, and then his brothers and his older brothers will then go out and they'll clean them out. And 9 times out of 10, they eat them for lunch before I even get home.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. They like to make, like, you know, fajitas and they chop it all up. They'll figure out, we get all the processing stuff. So if they want to make burger out of it, they'll make burger out of it. And yeah, they have fun with that. So
that's very cool.
I try to get them to save some for me most of the time. So
that's a good problem to have. My wife will cook it and she's awesome at it, but she won't eat it. So when she makes a duck, she normally makes whatever she's making, she'll make a chicken version and a duck version. Well, out of 10 people that I've met, if you say, here's duck, here's chicken, people go for the chicken.
Yeah.
And so I don't mind eating the duck, but it's like, I shoot enough. Like, I shot, 141 total waterfowl last year. It's like, I would like some help.
Yeah.
Some people could help me out on that.
Yeah. You don't want that. You don't want them sitting in the freezer too long. That's for sure.
Yeah. Time to time happens, but
I know I still have a couple sitting in there, but I'm like, all right, I'll make some jerky out of them for the kids. Yeah. It doesn't usually, they usually like that. It doesn't last long. So
how do you make jerky? The one time I tried to make it, it ended up so brittle. It was just like cracking my teeth.
Yeah. You gotta be really careful. So I found over the years, I have a meat slicer, so I would slice them. I'd slice the breast up, but then I actually prefer now what I'll do is I'll just get a really sharp knife. And I will just cut them thin, but probably like an eighth of an inch. So they're almost like you would for like a fajita size, you know, if you would go out and get fajita steaks. Mm-hmm, so they're a little thicker. And then I put them in the dehydrator. But the idea with duck is don't put them in the dehydrator very long. I probably put them in there for maybe 4 to 6 hours. And that's it. And then they're done. And I will marinate them with something for at least 24 to 48 hours too, mm-hmm. Just to kind of get some more of that, you know, that, the juices in there. But yeah, if you too thin, they just, it's like chips. All apart. Nobody
for
likes
me,
them.
It was gamey tasting chips when I did it.
Yeah. You're eating it from the handful to the bag. You're just doing one of these things like the chip bag. Just getting lots of crumbs out of it.
Yeah, it
wasn't. Yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Wasn't
so that good. That's never any fun. But yeah, we try to. We do a lot of jerky with things. A lot of times, if we can't get to it, we'll do jerky. The kids will do it. They like the. My kids are all homeschooled, so they. Mm-hmm. So they have little projects they have to do anyway. So that's one of them.
For you. Good for you guys homeschooling. I think that's the wave of the future. With that,
it is
going. So
it is.
Bravo for that.
Yeah, it's something that we decided we were going to do when they got to high school. Mm-hmm. My kids are very they're self-taught. They learn very quickly and they're very motivated. So we figured by the time they get to high school, we'll get them away from all that social drama. Wow. And then, but then COVID hit and we saw what they weren't learning and, or what they were, we thought what they right. were learning and we pulled them all, except for my son. My son with special needs actually goes to a school for autistic kids.
Fantastic. You
know, he goes there daily, but they're more of a, trying to teach the kids like vocational stuff versus, right. you know, skills. They're not getting into the social stuff, but especially in Massachusetts where we are, it's pretty tough up here.
That's great. You have access to a school like that. Cause I've been a teacher since about, 97, and inclusion into the classroom for a long time was kind of the practice. And I think that from what I've seen, sometimes it becomes babysitting and not teaching those skills that they actually like. Professionals that are trained to teach those skills.
Yeah, you're just not equipped for that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Then, so that's fantastic.
And that's probably the only reason, if you ask me and my wife, that's probably the only reason why we're still in Massachusetts is because the school districts pay for those kids because they know that they can't, they're just not equipped for it. They try, you have to go through a process like he was in the public school system, but then they get to a point there where they're like, okay, listen, he's not learning anything from us. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the severity of the child too. So, sure. And for us case, when he's nonverbal and, you know, he just turned 14 today, but if you would just look at him, you would think he was a 5 or 6 year old kid. So he doesn't, he's the third child, so he's also a little bit of a punk, but
always those young ones. Boy, our youngest is a 16-year-old girl and she's got a lot of fire in her belly. Yeah. I'll tell you that one.
Yeah. My youngest is we have four, and we were going till we had a daughter, and she'll be 12 in July, but she keeps me on my toes, that's for sure.
All right.
I never became I was never a proponent for arranged marriages until I became a father of a daughter.
Amen to that. Boy, people gripe and talk about how hard toddlers are. Wait till they're teenagers, huh?
Oh, man, so tough. That preteens, when they all of a sudden, man. They're like, no, and they say no, and they start talking back, and you're like, what happened to you?
Yeah.
Where is my child and what have you done with them?
Yeah. And they think they know everything. They think they're so smart. I'm thinking, you've done nothing. You have no life experience. You have basically no education. You're a moron who thinks you're a genius.
Yeah,
you think you know more about the world than I do and you're going to tell me.
Yeah, I have a 17 and a 19-year-old. So, yeah, those conversations happen quite often. Yeah, dad doesn't know anything.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Then they'll hit 25 and they'll be calling dad constantly somewhere around 23, 24. All of a sudden you become cool and smart again because life just like starts knocking them out. And they're like, whoa, hold on.
I'm 47. I still call my dad every day.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, PJ, I appreciate you coming on here. This has been a fun conversation. People get nervous about these things. Like, do you ever sit around with friends and talk about duck hunting? There's no reason to be nervous.
No, you're talking about duck hunting. No, my wife, I told my wife, I said, oh, I'm going on a podcast today. And it's usually for my business. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of podcasts for the business. You get on invited guests and I'm like, no, this one's actually something I want to talk about.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, what could that be? I'm like, duck hunting. And she's like, are you kidding me? actually, this is something I want to talk about. So, and then I miss it already. You know, it's the end of the season. Our season ends early January, but it's like, I'm already planning for this coming season. So,
new
spots to go to. I try to add a couple new spots every year. So,
it's a good goal.
Yeah, you lose some spots over the years too. So then people start finding your little spots and your honey holes, and then you gotta, then they start invading, and you gotta figure out another spot. So
that's absolutely true. Every time I find a place I'm in love with, it has about a 5-year window, it seems like, and something happens to it, whether it's other people or it just dries up or the conditions change, and it's very, very common for me to. It's like about a 5-year window once you find it. It seems like sometimes not even that.
Yeah, you're lucky. You're lucky. I mean, I have a couple of spots that I've been hunting for over 20 years now, but those are spots I go to. I'm very particular when I go out there. It's got to be the perfect scenario. The water's got to be, it's got to be after rain. It's got to be when the water's high. I got to really sneak in there because, again, I know they're really good spots, but I'm just even though they're public, I still feel like they're my spots.
Oh, absolutely.
Because nobody else is in there. Over those years, I've maybe seen one or two guys, you know, try to get in there, but they usually don't, you know, I can hear them again. They're out by the boat ramp or the canoe launch or something like that. Mm-hmm. They're not very far. But you can hear them, and then you're trying to figure out who they are and where they parked, and
just
let them know, hey man, if you're going to come out here, let's do this together. Let's team up. So
that's right. Well, cool. Well, it sounds like you've carved out a nice little space for yourself out there where you're able to really get after it and have a good time. So I really appreciate you coming on here and just kind of educating me about that area, because it's really interesting to me and your business and everything. So,
well, if you ever find your way out here, let me know. You can look me up.
The more contacts I get, the more likely I am to go to someplace, especially someplace like the East Coast with so many people. But it would be interesting for me to experience that area of the world just to be there and sample some of the big cities and some of the hunting. That would be interesting. So,
we have our similar hunting styles too. So,
right,
fantastic. Based off from what I've heard how you talk, I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy hunts exactly like I do. So
that's cool. That's cool. Well, I'm going to shut this one down. Don't leave until once I shut it down. Stick around with me for a second.
Yeah.
The rest of you, thank you for listening. You have listened to another episode of the North American Waterfowler Podcast.